Will you be thinking about lunch, work, family, or the weekend football game? You can't make an accurate prediction because a thought, like a quantum, has no properties before it pops into existence. There's no mystery to this if we honor Einstein's warning that we shouldn't play games with reality. What physicists called quantum indeterminacy stands for the fact that quanta can't be known until the very moment of measurement. The same is true of thoughts, words, human behavior, and the evening news. The reason we rush to find out the latest disaster on the evening news is that we are well adapted to reality as a messy, unpredictable thing, rough around the edges, and ruled by uncertainty. The quantum revolution didn't introduce these elements into our lives. It merely expanded them from the human into the quantum world. Are we ready now to take the big leap and say that human beings created the quantum world? Not quite. The issue of how an observer affects reality hasn't been settled. Some very strange quantum behavior still needs to be domesticated. But we've reached a turning point. The Heisenberg cut, in real-life terms, is a mirage. All of us live in the multidimensional quantum world. We project ourselves into everything we experience, not just by observing, but by participating in the reality that emerges. When we do this, are we being self-centered, injecting human qualities into the universe because it suits our vanity? Or did the universe already contain mind in the first place? That's the hot-button issue lying at the heart of the next mystery. Do we live in a conscious universe? For the average person, the notion of infinite universes bubbling up here, there, and everywhere is a nice piece of imagination, or could be pondered as weird science. In any case, there are many skeptics to challenge the multiverse, and as the argument rages, a bystander might raise his hand and ask, "Do we actually know what this universe is like? Never mind all those others." It's a valid point. The multiverse is like a romance novel for the whole human race. In romance novels, the heroine ultimately finds Mr. Right. In the multiverse, human beings have found Mr. Right Cosmos. Except that the odds of finding the right cosmos are essentially zero, vanishingly smaller than the chances of finding Mr. Right in everyday life. The only question is whether, like our Harlequin heroine, fate made the perfect match, or it was simply dumb luck. In this audiobook, we're saying it is neither. The perfect match between human beings and the universe is about a meeting of the minds. The human mind matches the cosmic mind. In some mysterious way that science hasn't explained, we find ourselves living in a conscious universe. Or to be truly mind-bending, we live in an unbounded state of consciousness that we call the universe. Massive skepticism would greet this proposition at a typical physics or neuroscience conference, but we've already seen the mounting evidence of how the quantum domain acts in a mind-like way. This evidence has been studiously ignored. In modern physics, consciousness has been like a black hole, swallowing up every investigator who has tried to give definitive answers. No one has ever written a book titled Mind for Dummies, because the topic has defeated, and continues to defeat, the most brilliant thinkers. Humans are in the ironic position of knowing for certain that we have a mind, while at the same time finding that our mind can't explain itself. Just asking, where does a thought come from, leads to bafflement, loud arguments, and a severe headache. Yet the beauty of a conscious universe lies in how many questions it solves at one stroke, as follows. Question: are human beings the only conscious creatures on Earth? Answer: no. All living creatures participate in cosmic consciousness. In fact, all so-called inert objects participate in it too. Question: does the brain produce the mind? Answer: no. The brain is a physical instrument for processing mental events. Mind and brain can both be traced to the same source: cosmic consciousness. Question: is there consciousness out there in the universe? Answer: yes and no. Yes, there is consciousness everywhere in the universe. No, it isn't out there, because in here and out there are no longer relevant concepts. The simplicity of these answers is what appeals to any scientist who accepts the possibility of a cosmic mind. We are steadily climbing out of the black hole. Today, there are papers, books, and conferences devoted to the conscious universe, and a mini revolution is underway. To be realistic, though, mainstream science still prefers to ignore consciousness. Science is in the habit of excluding assumptions that aren't necessary to solving a problem. In the working world of physics, it's irrelevant to E equals mc squared, or the Schrödinger equation, or chaotic inflation if the universe is conscious. A huge amount of productive science has emerged by excluding the entire issue of the mind. Just as treating a baby as a puppet is workable at a certain level. But that's not the really peculiar part. What we find eminently strange is that scientists consider their own minds irrelevant. It's simply a given, like breathing. When someone is bombarding protons in a particle accelerator, nobody says, "Make sure you're breathing," much less, "Make sure you're conscious." Both are irrelevant assumptions. And yet, looked at another way, nothing is more important than the mind, especially if the human mind is somehow in sync with a cosmic mind. It matters to all of us if human beings have a cosmic dimension. All talk about being merely a speck in the vast coldness of outer space would come to an end forever. As Wheeler poetically put it, we are the carriers of the central jewel, the flashing purpose that lights up the whole dark universe. Grasping the mystery. The main roadblock to a cosmic mind is the assumption that the mind is always tainted by its subjectivity. Subjectivity is alien to data and numbers, the stuff that makes science a viable activity. General agreement is reached by studying the facts and nothing but the facts. In consciousness studies, however, objectivity is classified as a separate variety of human awareness, known as third-party consciousness, meaning that any third party can come on the scene and agree with what has been observed. For example, consider a team of geologists picking over the ground at Point Trinity, the spot in the New Mexico desert where the first atomic bomb was exploded on July 16, 1945. The first geologist spies an unusual mineral lying on the ground. As they examine it, the second geologist agrees that it looks like nothing he's ever seen before. The rock specimen is tested by other geologists, and a consensus is reached. The enormous heat of that first atomic blast created a mineral unknown anywhere else on Earth, which they named trinitite. The desert sand, composed primarily of quartz and feldspar, was fused into this glassy green residue, which is mildly radioactive but not dangerous. The discovery of trinitite neatly conforms to third-party consciousness. By eliminating all subjective reactions, known as first-party consciousness, objectivity is assured, or so they say. There is also second-party consciousness, the you, that sits across the table from me. Second-party consciousness is almost as untrustworthy as first-party consciousness, since two people can share the same delusion. No one has shown how to go from two observers sharing the same experience to actual objectivity. Throwing out any reference to consciousness except for the third-party kind is enormously convenient if you're a physicalist. It also sweeps a huge amount of experience under the carpet, all along saying this is the only way to do science. Looking around at the modern world, which was built on science and technology, one is looking at the vast possibilities of third-party consciousness. You can see why science is so eager to throw out first-person consciousness, the eye of everyday experience. Rembrandt can say, "That's my self-portrait," but Einstein can't say, "That's my relativity." If you want some relativity, get your own. Yet by making third-party consciousness the norm, we wind up with a science fiction world where no I exists. To see the weirdness of the situation, try walking around and referring to yourself only in the third person. He just got out of bed. She is brushing her teeth. They seem reluctant to go to work, but they have to put food on the table. It cannot be denied that subjectivity is messy. But it's also how experience works. Things happen to people, not to pronouns. Naturally, every scientist has an I and a personal life. But in the models of reality developed by physics and modern science in general, the universe is a third-party experience. As John Archibald Wheeler famously said, "It's as if we look at the universe through a foot-thick piece of glass when what we should be doing is breaking the glass." An unconscious universe is a dead universe, while the universe that human beings experience is alive, creative, and evolving toward magnificent structures that are even more creative. If the latest data from the Kepler Observatory are valid, the number of Earth-like planets in the observable universe may be as many as 1 followed by 22 zeros. The enormous number of planets that might sustain life could be proof that a conscious universe is expressing itself many times over. The argument about how humans evolved on Earth can't be settled as long as consciousness itself remains a mystery. When we talk about it, consciousness needs to be clear, reasonable, and believable. No mode, first person, second person, or third person, can be banished. There must be a level playing field, with no pronouns playing favorites, just because they can get away with it. When atoms learned to think. Everything in the cosmos is either conscious or unconscious. Or, to be more precise about our terms, an object is either participating in the domain of mind, or it isn't. Choosing which is which, however, isn't as easy as it appears. Why do we say the brain is conscious? The brain is made up of ordinary atoms and molecules. Its calcium is the same as the calcium in the White Cliffs of Dover. Its iron is the same as the iron in a twopenny nail. As thinkers, nails and the White Cliffs of Dover aren't famous. But we all accept that the human brain has a privileged place in the universe, meaning that its atoms are somehow unique compared with the same atoms in dead matter. When a molecule of glucose passes through the blood-brain barrier, a cellular gatekeeper that determines which molecules are allowed to pass from the bloodstream into the brain, the glucose doesn't change physically. Yet somehow, it contributes to the processes we call thinking, feeling, and perceiving. How can the simple sugar regularly used to nourish hospital patients through an IV tube learn how to think? That question goes to the heart of the mystery. If all objects in the universe are either part of consciousness or are not, the conscious ones learned how to think. And yet no one has ever explained how this occurred. Really, the whole notion of atoms learning to think is totally irrational. The exact moment when atoms acquired consciousness will never be located, linking mind and matter has been labeled the hard problem and has become the focus of intense debate. Out of the 118 elements found, only 6 make up 97% of the human body: carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. If anyone hopes to mix and match these atoms in such a hugely complex way that they suddenly start to think, this would seem like a naive goal. But in essence, that's the only explanation offered for how the human brain became the organ of consciousness. With billions of base pairs contributing to the double helix of human DNA, complexity becomes bewildering enough to serve as a plausible cover for ignorance. Telling which objects are conscious and which are not is very tricky. Calling the entire cosmos conscious is just as plausible as calling it unconscious. The argument can't be settled simply on physical grounds. The mystery boils down to a clear-cut choice. Is the universe made of matter that learned to think? Or is the universe made of mind that created matter? We can call this the divide between matter first and mind first. Although matter first is the default position of science, the quantum century seriously undermined it. One popular view tries to rescue the matter first position by cleverly turning everything into information. We are surrounded by information on all sides. If you receive an email announcing a sale on smartphones, a piece of new information has come your way. Yet the photons that strike your retina as you read the computer screen also carry information, which gets transformed into faint electrical impulses in the brain that are another kind of information. Nothing is exempt. At bottom, anything a person can say, think, or do can be computerized in the form of digital code, using only ones and zeros. A model can be developed where the observer is a bundle of information looking out upon a universe that is an even bigger bundle of information. Suddenly, mind and matter find common ground. Some cosmologists consider this a viable alternative to a conscious universe. All it takes, we are told, is to define consciousness purely as information. An articulate proponent of this view is physicist Max Tegmark of MIT. He begins his argument by dividing